Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Don't touch that dial. You're tuned in to the Dread Podcast Network.
Welcome to Development Hell. For every horror movie that hits VOD, countless others end up DOA. Development Hell is the podcast dedicated to unearthing these cursed horror productions. We're going to find out what went wrong, and then decide if these titles still stand a shot at the green light. I am your host, Josh Korngut. I am the managing editor of Dread Central. I am also a filmmaker in Toronto, Canada. This podcast is a proud member of the Dread Podcast Network. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to a brand new episode of Development Hell. We are back from a couple months hiatus, and we are here with another limited audio series, this time about the unmade works of George A. Romero. Welcome to the third episode of Romero Unseen. In this third episode of the miniseries, we're going to be talking about his never-made adaptation of The War of the Worlds by novelist H.G. Wells. Joining me for the Romero Unseen limited audio series here on the Dread Podcast Network is Adam Charles Hart. He is the author of the book Raising the Dead, the work of George A. Romero, which is out now from Oxford University Press. You can find where you can get your own copy at the show notes, so you can go there now and take a look. Adam, we're excited to have you on for yet another episode of this mini-series. For people that maybe haven't tuned in for the first two episodes, could you introduce yourself to the Development Hell and Dread Central audience?
Hey, I'm Adam. Nice to meet everyone. How are you doing? I'm an archivist and a writer, and my book is all about George Romero, including both his massive archive of unproduced scripts and his more famous movies. And I had a whole lot of fun writing it, and it's really exciting that it's now out in the world and not just a little bit scary too. I think we've been talking about it before. Like, it's very exciting, the possibility that people might read it. It's also very terrifying, the possibility that, wow, people might read it.
Yeah, and now it's out there for everyone to see. Tell us, how did you get the opportunity to write this book? Like, how did you get sort of into the archives?
I was at the University of Pittsburgh teaching when Romero's archives came, and during the pandemic, was able to get a position that mixed teaching and research with processing George's archives. So me, along with my former colleague Ben Rubin, we were the first ones to dig through all these cardboard boxes filled with, you know, sometimes unmarked envelopes that may contain, you know, his sci-fi adaptation of Macbeth called Mickey B.
What?
That he wrote in the 2000s.
Why didn't you tell me about this yet?
Well, what? I feel like I have just now given it about as much attention as it merits.
Oh my God, why are we doing a War of the Worlds episodes? We
yeah.
keep doing that.
So it might be that, or it might be handwritten rewrite pages from like the set of Night of the Living Dead. It was all very exciting. We had no idea what would be in there. But also, there's just like, there have been a couple of interviews where Romero talks about some of the unproduced scripts he wrote, but like, there are so many. So many dozens of them. And then if you start including just like treatments and fragments or stuff that like other people wrote that he contributed to, like you start getting into like the hundreds. It's just really cool to, you know, share my excitement about all of that with other people.
Well, I'm gonna have to take the pilgrimage down to Pittsburgh one of these days. It sounds to me like you're living the rockstar life right now. Are you on the road promoting the book?
I live in Pittsburgh, but am frequently in Chicago for work, where I work mostly remotely, but for an archive based here. But I am doing my first event for the book that I'm just so thrilled about. On Saturday, March 23rd, me and Dan Krause, the author of Whalefall, which is everybody's favorite movie from last or favorite book from last year. If you haven't read it, go pick it up. It will be your favorite book. But who also finished George Romero's unfinished novel, The Living Dead. And he's a really great guy. And maybe the most knowledgeable person about George Romero on the planet, you know, who didn't spend 2 years digging through their archives. Well, that sounds pretentious, but you know what I mean.
It's true.
But anyway, so Dan and I will be at the Gene Siskel Film Center in Chicago on March 23rd for a screening of Night of the Living Dead. He and I will talk about the book and talk Romero and then screen one of the greatest movies ever made. So if you live in Chicago, come to it. It's going to be an absolute blast. And then the following week, March 28th, I'm going to do a reading at George's alma mater at the Carnegie Mellon University, which is, you know, it's sweet and poetic to do something like that. That will be at their Studio for Creative Inquiry. And I'm thrilled about both of those. And then in April and May, I've got more stuff coming up in Boston. And it looks like maybe a couple things in Seattle and then Portland, as well as maybe a couple more things in Pittsburgh. But, you know, if you're a theater programmer or bookstore owner and want to do something Romero related, please track me down. It's a lot of fun talking George with the fans of him.
Yeah, very cool. What a nuts legacy to be a part of. If it's okay with you, I'm thinking maybe I'll give a bit of a seminar on what the War of the Worlds was, because there's a lot to know, and you know, some of this was news to me.
Go for it.
So the novel, The War of the Worlds, is a science fiction work by English author H.G. Wells. And I don't think we're actually certain of exactly when it was published, but it was around 1896. To my knowledge, this is one of the earliest science fiction works about aliens battling humans and, yeah, all of that good sci-fi violence. There were, of course, a number of really well-known adaptations. Probably most famously was the 1938 radio play by filmmaker Orson Welles. You may remember learning about this as the event that famously caused panic amongst listeners because they believed what they were listening to over the radio was real, which, whoa, what a weird thing to have witnessed.
But it was basically the radio equivalent of a found footage film, right?
Yeah.
Like, so that it was... Wells adapted it as if it was like a series of on the scene news reports from, you know, where uh-huh. the alien invasion is happening. And, you know, Romero knew this because he idolized Orson Welles. Like, he ripped him off, in his own words, as much as he could, especially in Night of the Living Dead, but throughout his career. Like, he just really admired Orson Welles' work. But, and he cites it in Diary of the Dead. Like, there's mm-hmm. a reference, you know, blink and you'll miss it, but there's a reference to Orson Welles in there, to the War of the Worlds.
Well, it may have been a little sensationalized for the 1938 radio production, but I think I learned about a 1949 version as well in Ecuador, where they also did a radio version where people believed it was real. And this time, mobs set fire to the radio station and 15 people actually died. Are you familiar with this?
I don't know anything about that.
It is. So I think it's called Quito, I think is the name of the town in Ecuador where it happened. Pretty frightening stuff. And this is, what, 10 years after the first one? But I guess people weren't aware. So War of the Worlds, is it real? We still don't know. So yeah. And there was also a 2005 adaptation starring Tom Cruise. I don't think we need to get too deep into that. The story concerns a first-person narrator who takes his wife to safety and refuge during a Martian attack. These Martians are housed often in these giant fighting machines, aka these tripods that are attacking Earth with heat rays and chemical weapons, black smoke, all sorts of nastiness. And, well, to make a long story short, the Martians basically seem to win, leaving the Earth in this post-apocalyptic state with this prickly red weed overtaking the world as well. And all hope is lost, but in the end, conveniently, it turned out that the aliens were susceptible to these invisible germs or pathogens on planet Earth that, of course, they have no immunity for, and they die. And then we got a nice, neat, tidy little ending. There are some interpretations to what Welles was talking about in this story. So he was a student of Henry Huxley, who himself was a big proponent of the theory of survival of the fittest. So some people believe that this story was really pulling from the idea of survival of the fittest, but we also have concepts of colonialism and imperialism. You know, Britain, where this takes place, I think at the time of publication, I could be wrong, so I need to check on this, but they were holding stake of a large portion of the planet at that time through colonialism. And Martians in this story were using similar tactics to achieve this kind of overtaking, like new technologies and violence and all sorts of mean tactics. There's actually an interesting monologue from chapter one called The Eve of War. Would it be okay if I read that section to you?
Go for it.
And before we judge them too harshly, we must remember what ruthless and utter destruction our own species has wrought, not only upon animals such as the banished bison and the dodo, but upon its own inferior races. The Tasmanians, in spite of their human likeness, were entirely swept out of existence in a war of extermination waged by European immigrants in the space of 50 years. Are we such apostles of mercy as to complain if the Martians warred in the same spirit? And while some of that is phrased kind of strangely, I see what he's saying. Like, I think the allegory of colonialism being this terrible, violent, and destructive thing is pretty obvious. What are your thoughts here?
Well, that's what Romero responded to the most strongly and the most immediately.
Colonialism.
His version of the script has almost nothing to do with the original story.
Okay.
But it really picks up on that, and like what it picks up that's kind of there in the original novel, but that becomes, like, you know, explicit, it becomes not subtext but like the text in Romero, is the idea of, well, basically of the tables turning, right? That America, this colonial power that has exploited its minorities. And, you know, like he makes explicit references to like the history of slavery and other kinds of exploitation, that somebody else is going to do that to us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's scary about it. That's what the, you know, like, big like allegorical conflict is. Mm-hmm. It's not just like scary aliens are going to kill us, but like there is this reckoning, right? Of like, well, we have this history, we know what the aliens are going to be like, and there is a heroic black character who's very much kind of in the realm of Ben from Night of the Living Dead, who, you know, voices it explicitly, like, we know what the aliens are going to do because America has done it to its black citizens. And
God, I wish that movie could have been made. People would have been so mad.
It's really good. It's a really great screenplay. It's so fun.
Before we get
and to smart, the, but
I mean, listen, that are two things that Romero, you know, was good for. But before we get into the nitty gritty of the script, I'm wondering if you could give us just a little bit of context, you know, of when he made this project or when he was writing the script. Where was he in his career? This was what, like the late 80s? What was going on with Romero at this time?
Right. So the last couple of things we talked about were from the 90s, which is kind of this wilderness period where Romero wasn't getting films made. He was selling scripts and like kind of making a lot of money, but wasn't getting films made, and it was getting increasingly frustrated. But also he wasn't shooting anything. So he kind of had time to like write all day long, every day, basically. But in the 1980s, you know, he was pretty prolific in terms of like what actually got in front of cameras. And so he was writing a lot, developing a lot of stuff. He was doing a lot of collaborations, with other writers, but it wasn't quite at the same pace as he would, you know, just a few years later. But this came in 1986 is when he wrote War of the Worlds. And it was at one point like on Paramount or CBS, Paramount's production schedule. Like it was bought and ready to go. And we can talk a little bit about that later, but this was going to be his first film after Day of the Dead. So if I could just sort of step back and talk about, you know, Romero post Dawn of the Dead, just give a real quick history. So Dawn of the Dead was a gigantic global hit. It was a total surprise. Nobody was expecting it, except maybe Dario Argento, I guess, who funded most of it. You know, it was released unrated. It was this like zombie movie with some gross out effects and some slapstick comedy, and it had a lot to say, and there are some cool action sequences and all of that, but nobody expected it to be like giant. But it was, and it was big enough that Romero was able to kind of parlay that into a three picture deal with an independent funder. The only condition for that was that one of the movies had to be another zombie movie. It had to be Day of the Dead. But then for the first two, he could make whatever the hell he wanted to make. The first one that he makes is a movie that I love, but have you seen Knight Riders, Josh?
No.
So I adore this movie. It's a wonderful, lovely, strange little movie, but there is no universe in conceivable existence in which a talkie movie about a Renaissance fair motorcycle jousting troupe arguing with each other about the ethics of selling out in extremely sincere terms that lasts 2.5 hours is going to be a blockbuster hit.
Okay.
I should say originally lasted 3 hours. I'm like the only person who didn't work on the film
who's seen the three hour cut. Was that Paramount? Who let that happen?
No. This was an independent. It was an independent film producer named Salah Hassanin, and okay. he uh, Like, yeah, I love that film, but there's no way that was ever going to be a hit. Am I wrong?
Did he not do a sequel for that film?
To Knight Riders? No.
Yeah. No? Okay, sorry.
No. But so then the next thing he made was Creepshow with Stephen King, everybody's favorite movie, if you have any taste, right? Oh, yeah. It's a lot of fun. It's beloved, something that people revisit all the time. But it kind of only did okay.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like, I spoke to some people who worked on it, and like the general consensus was that, so that was produced independently, but then distributed by a big studio.
Warner,
and the studio, like, it did very well. It was like number one in the country for the first week. And then the studio pulled all advertisements, not just on TV, but like in newspapers too, or something like that.
Really?
This is a very subjective, you know, account. This is not, it's not because George didn't write it. It's not one of the ones that I did a ton of research on for the book. So it just kind of, petered out very quickly.
I mean, just quickly, because I'm such a fan, why would you guess that would have happened? The lack of support after a good first week?
I think that it just has to do with the way that they thought about horror movies, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it's not something that they wanted to put any resources or time or energy into.
It made its money. They were done. They were moving on.
I kind of think that was it.
I mean, it still kind of happens. Like, horror movies will plummet often in their second week, and maybe it's because of that lack of support. I don't know.
Yeah. And, you know, like, it definitely found its audience, right? Like, on video, people came around and they got a chance to see it. But, like, even though Stephen King at the time, this is, what, 81? 82? Anyways, even though like he was a big name at the time, he wasn't like the brand that he would be just a few years later, right? So it wasn't like Warner's needed to like keep him happy or whatever.
Interesting. I didn't realize he hadn't reached his peak at that point.
Like he was getting there very, very quickly. But also at the same time, like he was an author. You know, and this was his first screenplay, and it didn't have like a book tie-in.
Yeah,
you know, it wasn't like The Shining or Carrie, which were both like very successful, but those were also best-selling
books
that people knew. And this was just like, it was just Stephen King's name. There's no familiarity with a story like, you know, The Crate that was published in a porn magazine. Where men supposedly sent in pictures of their wives and girlfriends. I've seen now that.
That's called revenge porn. But some of his best works were from like Playboy. So some of his best
shorts. I mean, he always said like they actually paid. Yeah, he wasn't going to knock it. He had made two films on this. Romero had made two films on this three picture deal. One was an utter flop. Right. One was like, not exciting. And then the third one was Day of the Dead, which he had been planning since Dawn, basically.
Okay.
It was going to be this giant epic project where like all of the like political critiques that he had been making was going to be realized with like this huge cast that populated an entire hierarchical system, you know, after the apocalypse, where there's like the military and these like cartoonish Roman emperor oligarchs who run everything with the military, and then scientists and other people that work for them who are kind of trying to navigate this, but then all of these lower classes that include both people and zombies. The zombies have been enslaved and sort of trained to do all of the grunt work for the upper classes, but the people at the bottom are treated with even more disdain than the zombies, possibly. including, and I can't remember if I've mentioned this on the podcast yet, but there is one detail in the original Day of the Dead scripts that will like haunt me for the rest of my life. Which is that there, you learn that there are farms of children that are being used to keep the zombies fed and happy.
Oh, good.
And it's just like, it's so horrifying, just the thought of it, you know?
They're young, so it doesn't take long, right? Like,
yeah.
That's smart.
Yeah. And there's like rebels working on the outside. And, you know, like in his other films, there's like metaphorical references to politics, but this was going to like show how everything is working. And it was all like exaggerated and a little bit cartoonish, but it was also just like, he was getting to work on a canvas that like he had never been able to before. But here's the thing. He had managed to write it for a relatively like modest budget. But the 1980s were a very repressive and censorious time, and like getting more so. Like they were getting more and more prudish.
Gotcha.
And the funder was really worried that if they submitted that script for a rating to the MPAA, they would get an X.
Okay.
And that was the goddamn kiss of death in the 1980s. That meant basically that it couldn't play anywhere.
Because the last movie got an X, right? And it was a huge success?
Dawn of the Dead was released unrated. Unrated. But that was in the 70s. Oh.
Okay.
So, like, things were a little bit more open back then, you know? It was the still mm-hmm. the swinging 70s a little bit. Everybody was, you know, a little bit more open. But also, people kind of didn't care about what, you know, some independent zombie movie was doing. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the 1980s... they eventually released Day of the Dead unrated, which meant that there were a lot of newspapers that would not print advertisements. I don't know if they were able to have TV ads anywhere. Uh-huh. Or if they did, it was like limited. And there were just like a lot of theaters that wouldn't show it. So like, you know, is it like the season 4 of Stranger Things or season 3 where it starts off with them sneaking into Day of the Dead and they mall multiplex and like that's a suburban multiplex at a mall in Indiana, like probably not gonna show Day of the Dead.
Wow, what a good nerd catch. That's great.
I mean that came out when I was like researching this book and I was like, no, that's not right. No, of course not. I'm sort of getting ahead of myself, but like Romero had planned out this huge epic and the funder was worried about the rating and told him, okay, you have a choice. You can write this so that it gets an R rating and you can make your epic. Or you can shoot it as is and you can get like $4 million, which is like less than half of what he had written the original script to be filmed for. And so... it was partially, you know, like an artistic decision, maybe, but I think it was more just like frustration from dealing with the MPAA. Like, I am never going to make this movie about zombies acceptable to these, you know, random faceless like prudes who want to censor this movie. They're going to give it an X no matter what I do. Yeah. So let's just rewrite the script so that it's like, you know, basically just a play that takes place in an underground bunker and there's some zombie action at the start and finish. Very much like Night of the Living Dead, but, you know, it's yet another Romero film that's basically a play about people getting increasingly tense and frustrated and angry in a small confined space. Yeah.
Do you think that could be a blessing in disguise? That, like, that could be what he was sort of meant to do creatively? Or do you think it's just sad that he would have been so disrupted from such a large vision?
I think that it's both, right? Like, I love Day of the Dead. It's a really sort of caustic, like, it's an angry movie, you know? And it, like, that passion and that feeling still comes through when you watch it 40 years later. Like, you still see that. And it really sort of stands as this, you know, amazing indictment of the era and, you know, these sort of like hyper masculine, macho military, like, ideology that was just sort of
rampant,
having free reign, you know, in the country, but also like in the cinema, you know, like that's the Sly Stallone, Arnold Schwarzenegger, like, shooting big guns and, you know, like, and making quips, era of action movies. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I can't help but feel this loss that Romero never got to make a film on that scale. You know, as much as I could appreciate and even love what he made it into, it is sad that he never got the chance to work on that canvas. It was something that he, you know, had wanted to do for a long time. He was an independent filmmaker who had to make a lot of, you know, really small, modestly budgeted pictures and did a lot with that. And
do you think he would have succeeded creatively at that scope?
I think so. Like, that is my favorite thing that he ever wrote, those early drafts of Day of the Dead. It's really vivid. He had so many ideas. And just like, you can see it on the page, just like how much he relished, like he just was enjoying writing these characters and creating a world in a way that he couldn't do when, you know, the movie was confined to like one farmhouse in the countryside or one mall or one bunker. And I don't know that he would repurpose a lot of the ideas 20 years later for Land of the Dead. Some of them would pop up in other projects. Some of them would make their way into War of the Worlds. But I don't know. You can't spend this much time, as I have with Romero's work, and not want to root for the guy, you know, like he seems snake bitten sometimes. And this was a chance to like do a kind of movie that he never made before. And that's sad, but I am happy with what we got. Releasing Day of the Dead unrated, and having it be this like smaller kind of angry screed against, you know, 1980s dominant culture did not, you know, that's not a recipe for giant box office receipts, you know? I don't know that it was really a flop, but it wasn't a success, and it was certainly a disappointment compared to Dawn. And so when George Romero starts working on War of the Worlds, he is just like in a really uncertain place in his career. He hasn't had a hit for a while, and that one hit was Dawn of the Dead, which is not like the sort of thing that respectable Hollywood executives celebrated, you know? Like, he was, at the time, like, he was able to get in the room for meetings, but nobody was prioritizing him, you know? Like, if they wanted a horror movie, they'd look at his scripts, but maybe they'd buy it, but they weren't gonna probably push it all the way into production, right? Like, he's just sort of at that level. And so he's starting this new phase. The three-picture deal is over. He's trying to figure out what's next. He's been working on a ton of stuff all this time, none of which is working out. And a lot of that was collaborations or stuff that he was working on with his production partner who split with him after Day of the Dead. Like, they had kind of been drifting away from each other for a while, but like that failure was sort of the financial failure was sort of the that was the straw that broke the camel's back there. And War of the Worlds is, as far as I can tell, the first new project that he undertakes to write on his own. So at the time, like stuff that was in the hopper that ended up not happening, the stuff that he was working on that eventually kind of shriveled up. One was the miniseries It, which he would have directed. He did not write the screenplay. Lawrence Cohen did, but he had a whole lot of input into it, including input that would like make its way into the eventual miniseries, you know, with Tim Curry. He was also working on Pet Sematary, but Pet Sematary was a script that Stephen King was writing. And as much as George was collaborative with his writers, you know, of all kinds, Stephen King, when he wrote a script, George basically wouldn't touch it. There would be like tiny changes for whatever reason. And basically with Pet Sematary, the timing just never worked out. Stephen King was off shooting Maximum Overdrive and there were
on something. Do you think that was out of respect or do you think it's just because King wrote impeccable scripts?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think they were perfectly simpatico on a lot of things. But as you know, Romero had no problem writing stuff. And he would eventually adapt Stephen King's stories, but there's like, there seemed to just be a difference for Romero when it came to like, well, this is a script written by Stephen King.
Yeah.
And you know, it's interesting if you think about Creepshow, that's like, that's Romero's most like visually interesting, like playful and experimental movie. And maybe that's because he just like focused all of his brain on like the image, you know, on like making it look fun and cool, and left the script to Steven, you know?
I mean, also like the whole world of EC Comics has so much visual, you know, subtext. So
yeah, but there had been adaptations of that stuff before and nobody did it like Romero did.
That's true. That one from the 70s, the UK one from the 70s, nothing visual happening there.
No, that is the definition of like fine. It's fine.
Oh, it's so boring. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah. He was also this would have been like at the very end, but he was working on over for several years on this project called Copperhead that was kind of like a RoboCop story, predated RoboCop by a ways, but it was a story that he wrote with Jim Shooter, the editor-in-chief of Marvel Comics, and they kind of traded off drafts, which was how they were collaborating. And that would have been, if they had produced it early on, it would have been the first Marvel movie.
Imagine.
I mean, you know, it's not a superhero movie. It's not an adaptation of their comics, but like it was announced, you know, like in the press as a Marvel co-production with George's company, Laurel Entertainment. And there were a few others. There was a Frankenstein adaptation. There was Apartment Living, which I mentioned last week, I think. But all of those are either working from somebody else's screenplay. And if it's not Stephen King, then he always has a lot of input or revisions. But, you know, he was busy making, like, actually filming stuff. So he was kind of working with other people and letting them do some of the work or the first draft or something. But then he sits down and writes War of the Worlds. So this is going to be, like, a new era in the George Romero career. Like it's going to be a transition. It has like it's, you know, it's an aliens and there's creatures and it's like close enough to horror that nobody's going to say like, why would George Romero get to make that? But it's science fiction. It's action. And he broke it into two parts. He only wrote the first script as far as I know, which is modestly it's written so that it could be filmed with a modest budget, you know. It's all about like one ship crashes into a skyscraper in advance of the big alien invasion. Like it, you know, it loses control or whatever and falls out. And it's just about people in that one building trying to, you know, survive the aliens that get out of it and learning about them and, you know, eventually fighting back. The setup for the next movie, which he never wrote, that would be the big one, right? That would be the one where Earth bands together or whatever to fight back against the battalion of spaceships that are waiting outside of the atmosphere to strike.
Would you mind if we just like took a hot second to talk about high-rise horror? Because it's something that I've always been very fascinated by, and it does arise in the career of Romero multiple times. And yeah. I was just doing an episode of Unmade Halloween Movies, and are you familiar that Halloween 2 originally was supposed to take place in a high-rise apartment complex? It was so close to getting made, there's like real promo artwork for it out there if you look hard enough. And like, can you imagine just that? And also Land of the Dead, of course, this is what that reminded me of. But like, there's some good high-rise horror too. And I grew up in a fucking apartment building. So like, I don't know. Do you have it? Like, when I say high-rise horror, what comes to your mind?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is David Cronenberg's Shivers.
Well, that's an interesting choice.
Well, I mean, I'm a big Cronenberg fan and I'm doing a lot of Cronenberg research lately, but that's... Nice. That's all about, you know, a virus running rampant through a high rise.
Excellent.
But I found today an advertisement for its screening at the Cannes Market, where the let me find it. Yeah. So the tagline is, this is when it was known as the Parasite Murders. So it says the Parasite Murders. A high-rise nightmare! Exclamation point.
That's so funny. So clearly there was something marketable about it. Also, Barbara Steele, right? That's the star of that?
She's in it.
I just love Barbara Steele. She's such like...
It's pretty great.
Oh my god, she's everything. And obviously there was... This year we had Evil Dead Rise, which I loved and I think a lot of people really liked.
It's such a great structuring principle for a script. Yeah. Because... Like, this sounds really idiotic to just, like, say it out loud, but, like, having to move up or down, you know, like, go up a floor or down a floor is, like, such an interesting decision that you can have characters make. Like, I don't know, if you saw the movie Dredd, the Judge Dredd movie, that's kind of all about that with two, you know, future cops having to... survive a high rise, a future post-apocalyptic type high rise that's filled with gangsters and such who are trying to kill them. Like the first Raid movie.
Oh yeah, Raid is such a good example.
Having to go up and down. It's like it's just like a great concept.
It's fun. Just a finite amount of exits. So like, you're fucked in a fire. You're fucked with a killer. You're just like, you're kind of fucked. So what are you going to do?
Well, and, you know, like, it's interesting the way Romero's script harkens back to Night of the Living Dead, where there's so much. There's only like two choices, right? You can stay on the main floor or you can go in the basement. But there's so much argument about it. And there's like very similar arguments in the War of the Worlds script about should we go up or should we go down? With this little group that forms and, you know, like the stakes are, they're like a little bit different when you have to worry about like dozens of floors versus just like
one level.
You know, like something that would take 15 seconds to walk all the way down if you take your time.
Yeah.
It's a good setting. It is kind of an expensive setting. And I don't know if that played into why they didn't eventually.
But it's also not that expensive because it's contained. So, like, there's only so many places to go. It kind of gives me Cube energy, 1997. Right? We've talked about Cuba.
There's also a little bit of Gremlins 2 in this. Oh, like, it's not
a little bit. A shit ton of Gremlins 2. That's the original high-rise horror movie.
Well, like in the script, there's not that much goofiness, but there's a little bit of that, like, this is an ultra modern, like, almost parody of an ultra modern high-rise skyscraper building, you know.
Was this what went on to become Land of the Dead, or is this fairly different?
This is different. It's clear that the idea of this, like, you know, shining tower that separates people from everything down below was an idea that stuck with him. But the basic setup is, you know, that the one plane crashes into this building and aliens get out and kill and mentally enslave people. And there's a small group of, various people from various places in the building who fight back. And that's, you know, that's pretty different from Land of the Dead. But you can see, like, the spark of the idea.
Would this be an okay time to, like, pick your brains about the archetypes and the characters that were in the script?
Sure. So, like, it's a pretty big cast.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't recall. It's going to be hard to recall everybody off the top of my head. So there's a, okay. So if I could talk about the cast a little bit, there's kind of two heroes. One is a reporter named Alan, boring white guy hero type. And the other is Zach, who's a janitor, who is a black man, as I said, like, very much in the vein of Ben from Night. Mm-hmm. The two of them kind of lead this group. It includes, you know, like, business people and other reporters and, like, an ex-girlfriend and, you know, various kinds of people that might be in the building. Then there's also the aliens. the human characters, like, Zach is the one who really stands out. He's mm-hmm. the one who has, like, very thoughtful but also very forceful things to say about, like, how this is reminding him of the history of slavery and, like, how they should, how they should fight back. And he is, the script's moral center, I would say, in addition to being its most heroic figure. And
let's talk about that, because I think when we talked about it earlier, it may have been offline, but how he tackles the idea of slavery in America as sort of a parallel to what's happening in War of the Worlds. And so you're saying this character Zach is, like, the one making that commentary, right? Like, he's the one who's saying, like, what they're gonna do to us is exactly what, you know, white people did to black people in America.
Yeah. So the aliens are, they are, like, they can take over people's minds, mm-hmm. they take over their bodies, but also they eventually have a conversation with this group, and they basically, like, offer them not a deal in the sense of, like, they can negotiate with, you know, the government or whatever,
mm-hmm.
but, like, a deal in the sense of, like, here's what we're doing. We are offering you a world without conflict, a world without, you know, violence or disagreement or anything like that. And, like, the humans immediately recognize it as slavery. And Zach has a speech near the end where he says, they were talking about us being slaves. My grandfather was a slave. You know, I know what that's like. He's saying, like, this is something that we know where that's going, that kind of exploitation and enslavement and lack of autonomy over our own bodies, over our own lives. It's really powerful. Yeah. It's really powerful. Zach's a really great character. And it ends with him originally like walking away. You know, like Alan and the girl Janet, they've defeated this one, you know, the aliens in the high rise, and Alan is like, yeah, we gotta go fight. You know, like warn everybody and tell them what we've learned. And Zach is kind of like, you know, this is not my fight.
Yeah, fuck that.
You know, like this is like I've survived. He's gonna try to survive on his own.
Mm-hmm.
But then the very end, he comes back and is like, you know,
joke.
He it's a touching moment when he decides he's actually gonna join them. He's gonna join the fight. He's going to kill those aliens.
He should have escaped. Wait, my question for you is, correct me if I'm wrong, so this was going to be a two-part event, like a two-film event, and what you're describing right now is what would have been the first half, War of the Worlds, The Night They Came. Is there anything you were describing beyond that?
No. The second part was never written.
Oh, okay, yes.
The night they came was the first part, and the second part would have been the day of combat. You can't get away from
the night, the day. People not happening. Yeah. Oh, that too.
Supposedly that would have been, that then would have been followed by, I don't know, the dawn of the aliens or the dusk of the aliens or something. If you like, wanted to take it to a part three.
He's a triptych baby. So, okay. So basically if War of the Worlds, The Night They Came did well, he had ideas for sequels. Is this my understanding?
The second part, what it was setting up was like a global battle. Like, yeah. It's not setting up the sequel in the sense of like, there's a cliffhanger,
mm-hmm.
You know, like it closes all the expected like narrative threads. They're all, you know, they're all tied up.
Tiny.
But then it is pointing out like, well, there's still a lot of ships out there in the atmosphere.
Yeah, we're fucked. There's going to be a lot of stuff happening outside. They follow the same formula of Night of the Living Dead trilogy, because you got the first one is in a contained space. The second time they're sort of in the world, still in a contained space. And I guess the third one, also a contained space. Never mind.
I was joking about a third one. There's no indication that there was anything than two.
But still.
But, yeah.
We were talking earlier, and I was saying, I like the name War of the Worlds, The Night They Came. And what did you say?
I said, you can tell that Romero came up with the title The Night They Came because it's terrible. Romero, as much as I love him as a writer, I have never known like a writer or anybody who's that talented, who is that terrible at picking a title.
I think that's subjective. I think it's fun. And campy.
Okay. Well, let's just go through.
It is terrible.
George's filmography.
Okay, let's
real quick.
Yes. Okay. Okay.
Okay. So name a good title. Night of the Living Dead. Great title. He didn't come up with it.
Oh, he didn't.
His original version was Night of the Anubis.
Oh God, wow. Buddy. No.
That's a terrible title. Then they changed it to Night of the Flesh Eaters, which is like,
all right,
it's getting there.
No. Living Dead is gorgeous. That's poetry.
Yeah.
I'm guessing he came up with the crazies, because that's a bad one.
Yep. That was also known as Codename Trixie and also Mad People.
Codename Trixie.
Three terrible titles. Three absolutely terrible titles.
About a drag queen. Season of the Witch is cute.
That was not... that was filmed as... Jack's Wife.
Oh, I see something.
Released as Hungry Wives.
Ooh, not Hungry Wives.
That was the distributor who wanted to make it seem like a sexy movie.
Okay, yeah.
Which there's like a sex scene. That's not...
Okay, hold on.
It's not a softcore movie or whatever.
A person's name...
And Season of the Witch came much later.
Okay. A person's name is always a classy title. So Martin, good title.
Is it?
I think so.
You hear the name Martin. Does that tell you this is a vampire movie?
No, but I think that's... Okay, yeah, it's not a good name, but I like it.
And also, I would say that's the best title he came up with.
Yeah, and that was the name of my first boyfriend. Hi, Martin. He's probably not listening.
Hey, Marty.
Oh, no. Martin, he came up with that, is what you just said?
Yeah.
Well, I like it. And then, yeah, as we were talking about earlier, the second Dead trilogy, no good titles in there. So,
Creepshow, great title. That was Stephen King's, you know. And,
next week, I think we're going to be talking about probably the worst title he's ever come up with. Yeah. Ever?
The footage.
The footage, yeah. But we'll talk about that.
Which soon. Is a fine title until you realize that it's a pun.
Oh, it's the funniest thing it's about, I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah, because it's about Bigfoots and... Maybe also because it refers to like football, maybe, but definitely Bigfoots. Oh, and then also like film footage. Like, oh, dear God.
And I also have no idea what Jakarta Joe was about, but that's a funny name.
Jacaranda Joe.
Oh, no. I'm going to cut this out. Jakarta is a place in Indonesia.
Yeah.
That would be cool. Jakarta Joe, like Indonesia City. That sounds like a cool movie. Doesn't that sound like an action like an action movie? Jakarta Joe?
Sure. I would watch it. If canon...
Maybe I'm not. Fascinating. Okay, I just have a couple more questions to you before we wrap up. Why did he get this opportunity? Is this just something that he did on spec and then someone said, sure, like, go ahead? Or did someone...
Yeah, this was... As far as I know... And, you know, like,
yeah,
because this is like a transitional time for him, you know, one of the things when you're dealing with like independent filmmakers, you can talk to people, including like relatives or like lifelong collaborators, who worked on a bunch of stuff, who won't know about certain periods because like they were less involved or were not involved. So, you know, like I talked to a bunch of people who were working with Romero in the early 1970s. None of them knew anything about the early version of Dawn of the Dead that he had written and was like meeting with people about. And this is kind of similar because this is, you know, this was a new producer. It never got to actual filming. So, you know, like his cinematographer or sound guys or editors, none of them would have been brought on board. But he was also going back and forth to Hollywood a lot more. Mm-hmm. You know, like his stuff, like the stuff in Pittsburgh had dried up a little bit and he was having to look outside for funding. And he was working with the studios a little more. So there's not the usual Romero folks don't necessarily know a lot about something like War of the Worlds. So with that said, what I can say is that as I understand it, Romero wrote it because he was really excited about the idea. He wanted to work on something new. There were a bunch of projects that were up in the air. So he just like did this while he was waiting to hear back from Stephen King about Pet Sematary and, you know, whatever else.
Cool.
And he sold it to Paramount. I think that's right.
Yep.
They announced it. It was on their release schedule. But the story that I heard was that, so he wrote this in 86. It was not long after that Star Trek The Next Generation premiered.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a surprise hit. And that was produced by Paramount or CBS or, you know, whatever the you know, the relationship was. And so... they started looking for other familiar science fiction properties that they could turn into TV shows. Now, they had bought this script from George Romero, but obviously didn't feel any kind of like obligation.
Yeah.
Because they're like, well, let's just take War of the Worlds and do a War of the Worlds TV show.
It kind of makes sense. Yeah.
They took Romero's version off the schedule and instead made a like lower than low budget Canadian TV show called War of the Worlds that ran for 2 years.
I don't
and
like
that. Well, it's coming up a lot in this series, isn't it? Like,
it is.
Relationships to low budget Canadian production.
You wouldn't be here without Canada, okay? We are putting our fingers in everything. Wait a second.
So what I would say is just that, like, in the 1980s in particular, like a Canadian television production was like being funded by Hollywood. Like they would do that if they didn't need any stars and they didn't want to spend money on sets.
Yeah, if they wanted to make it so good and authentic, that's what they would do. They'd send it to us.
That's right.
I know.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly what I meant. thank you for understanding this.
So there was a production ultimately produced. Was any of his work in it? Like, was any of the influence a part of it?
None whatsoever. As far as I could tell from, like, you know, reading IMDb and
so they threw like a handful of trash. Things. They didn't hold on. There was no Bible out of it. They just got rid of it.
Yeah, no, they. They didn't want to have to pay George Romero for this. Are you kidding?
So rude. But I thought they did. No, I guess it was not real.
You know, like, it's a lot of money to you and me and to Romero, but like the amount of money that it costs to buy a script is just a fraction of what it costs to produce a movie and then market it and all of that, right?
Yeah.
So studios are much, as far as I know, like much more conservative now and have really sort of fine-tuned their methods in exploiting writers. But at the time, it was just kind of like they would plan to buy many more scripts than they would actually produce just because, like, you know, through the various like funding and production machinations, like, stuff wouldn't happen. So they just sort of plan on that. And that's just where Romero kept ending up. This one feels just like, this feels like a real poke in the eye, just like kicking the balls, right? Like, it's such a great idea to do something with War of the Worlds. We love this script. Screw you. You're not going to be involved at all. And you don't own the property. It's public domain. So what are you going to do, huh?
Yeah. Oh. That fucking sucks. Yeah, I'm looking up this 1988 TV series, War of the Worlds. Definitely shot in Toronto, so that's fun. It looks so bad. Wow.
It might be great, you know, like, maybe...
No, I don't know, not from the title card.
Maybe next week we can have, like, a listener on who can tell us all about how this is actually, you know, a... hero's journey, a story of how the amazing masterpiece War of the Worlds, the Toronto TV show, was made. And this was all just, you know, preamble for the greatness that was the show.
So I'm looking through and I was like, I have to find someone I recognize. I do. There's Rachel Blanchard. Why do
she
I know?
Like, third grade teacher, maybe?
Shut that. Rude. Okay, she was a main role on Seventh Heaven.
Okay.
I swear to God, got it. This is what I know her from. She was the lead of the Clueless TV show. She played Cher. Oh my God! And she was a lead on Are You Afraid of the Dark? She was one of the fucking Dusty Wusty kids. Yeah, I recognize this girl. So there are icons among us, and I just wanted to make sure we all knew. Anyway, we're back. Cool. I wish that this had been made. My question for you is, why didn't this happen, do you think? Like, was there a catalyst? What do we think literally went down? In terms of this production being canned.
I think it was just that they decided they wanted to use the title, like literally the title War of the Worlds, for a TV show. Because they wanted to do another sci-fi TV show. They could like put on the air. The weird thing is that they just ended up doing, you know, like a probably wonderful masterpiece of a Canadian TV show, but then they did it on like such a low budget. It just kind of feels like
thrown away. Like I don't know. You know, sometimes how studios this probably isn't the case. They have to do something. You know, those $300,000 Hellraiser movies that they put out because if they didn't do something with the property, they'd lose the IP. You think that could be part of it?
I mean, you know, War of the Worlds was written in the 19th century. It wasn't under copyright at that point.
But that doesn't mean... Okay, you would know this, but couldn't someone still claim copyright to it if they really wanted to? And therefore, it could still be under copyright if the family held on to it?
I think that there could be certain elements, not from the book, but like the design of the aliens is it the 30s?
Okay, I don't know. But
from No, it was later than that. But from the George Powell film, the Hollywood, 1953. The Hollywood version.
53. Yeah,
okay. Yeah. Yeah. So those could be under copyright.
Okay.
Romero's characters would have been under copyright, which is, you know, I'm sure had something to do with why they completely tossed out his, you know, structure and script and all of that, so that, you know, they would not have to say like co-created by George Romero and send him a paycheck for the TV show. I think that that's how I understand it, but I'm obviously not an expert.
Before we sort of conclude for today and find out more about where your book can be found, final question: War of the Worlds 2005. What do we think about that? What do we think about it?
I'm not a huge fan. I feel like there's something in Spielberg's pessimism, his cynicism about humanity, that rubs me the wrong way. While Romero's pessimism and cynicism about humanity seems to resonate with me, and I can't quite explain it.
That's so funny, because Spielberg is so Disney and Romero is not, but I like that anyway.
But War of the Worlds is like his really dark movie, you know, where like he's so the characters, Tom Cruise and his kids, have to be so afraid of everybody else. It just feels to me, it just like feels a lot more like, I don't know, like gated suburbs paranoia about everybody around you. Whereas Romero is like worried for like the state of civilization if we don't get our shit together.
Wow. Okay, so Spielberg's one is about white flight and Romero's is not. That's interesting.
Yeah. The big you know, like Tom Cruise has to like the big you know, task that he has to undertake is to take his spoiled kids. Like he's kind of a working class guy.
Yeah.
He's played by Tom Cruise, who never seems working class. Like, I don't know what his family is like, but, you know, he does.
Come on, guy.
Yeah. Yeah. But that he has to, like, take them in the midst of all of these, like, teeming masses of people who are all dangerous and crazy and, you know, probably smell bad, I guess. I don't know.
That's so funny. It truly is in opposition to what the book and Romero's approach were really about. And that's kind of funny.
I mean, I think it is, but okay, and the other thing is that, so Land of the Dead was Romero's like last big chance, right? Like he got biggest budget of his career, got movie stars, you know, not the biggest movie stars. There was some interference from the studio, but he, you know, basically he had to recast the hero so that he wasn't black.
They did.
The studio. Yeah.
Really?
Studio made him cast a white dude.
Well, it was Simon Baker. Who did they originally have? Do you know?
I don't think that it got to the casting stage. When I say it, I just mean that like he was written as a black character.
That sucks. That's so bad.
So basically, he ended up like giving a lot of that character's traits and actions to the John Leguizamo character, who gets a much bigger role in the film than he had in the previous scripts.
Okay.
So that at least there'd be somebody of color like in the lead.
Yeah.
But anyways, that opened like up against War of the Worlds, and War of the Worlds kicked its ass, you know.
Wow.
Steven Spielberg.
War of the Worlds. That's so like tragic and ironic. Is that tragic irony or am I wrong?
Yeah, it is. Okay. It's also, it feels really dumb on the studio's part. Like,
yeah.
Land of the Dead does not feel like a summer blockbuster to me. It feels like a September movie.
I was gonna say a January dump.
No.
But yeah.
Be kind. But no, it would do well in January the same way that like
it would do well,
I don't know, like a James Wan
movie. I was just going to say it, just like Night Swim. Which was terrible.
But yeah, because it would do well because it would stand out as like a really well-made film that was exciting and like had interesting performances and things to say, but that like people are in the mood for spooky stuff in September and October, or for some reason in January. Like, I don't know. I don't know if that has to do with like our mood as like a collective audience, or just that we've been conditioned by studios dumping their horror movies in January.
There's a theory that this is when they put out things that they like don't like. Well, they like kind of like it's like the dump zone, honestly.
Yeah. But I feel like I'm looking forward to the horror movies in January every year.
Oh, you know? Yes, me too. Yeah. I'll never forget. I learned this because I remember when Darkness Falls came out, I was still reading the paper because the paper still existed. And I remember reading the review in the Toronto Star and they were like, yeah, so January is when they dump shit like this. And it always kind of stuck with me.
Yeah.
I love Darkness Falls though. I really do. I really do. Okay, this has been another like honest to God fascinating as hell episode, so like thank you for joining me yet again. Before we let you go, I just want to talk for 3 seconds about your book one more time. Just remind us of the name, a little bit of what it's about, and where we can find it.
So it's called Raising the Dead, the work of George A. Romero.
Nice.
You can find it online at all the usual places. Some bookstores, but, you know, the film sections of bookstores are getting smaller and smaller. Seems like every week. You know, you can find it all over. If you are in Chicago, Pittsburgh, Boston, Seattle, or Portland, I'll be coming to you. And you can, buy one from me probably. It's a book about George Romero that tries to take into account everything that he did. You know, we talked a lot today about his frustrations with the studios, with like what he could get funded and like all these negotiations that he had with producers and all that about like, well, can I make this? What do I have to do to, you know, like get this made and whatever. And the fact is that, you know, he's got this archive of so many amazing scripts that in some ways like reflect who he is as an artist as much as or occasionally like even more than like the feature films. So this is an attempt to like do justice to the entirety of his filmography, including films that never got produced. You know, he was entertaining as hell as a writer, and so this is a place where you can read about some of these really fun scripts, but also like it just changes who he is, who we think of him as when you know read a script like War of the Worlds or Mickey B. the Macbeth.
We're going to talk more about that on the last episode, or just so everyone knows.
Sure.
Yeah.
Could I also say, like, so we're doing 2 more of these, is that right?
Yeah, 1 more traditional and then our wrap-up, yeah.
So can we start putting out a call for if anybody has any questions or wants to, you know, chime in, you know, be kind, please, but, you know, let us know what you think or what you want us to talk about for that final episode in 2 weeks.
Yeah. And you guys social media, you can let us know via email. Where can they get a hold of you if that's possible?
Well, the best way, I mean, if you just search Raising the Dead and my name, Adam Charles Hart, you can find the book. I'm on Twitter at m_Hulo or on Blue Sky at adamhart.bluesky. And you know, I write for a few different venues occasionally.
Oh really?
But
where?
I've most recently written for Defector, which is a culture, sports and arts website, cool. Politics and such. But nothing super recently and nothing coming up. I've been kind of focused on the book. But you know, you can find my stuff out there. I don't know.
He's out there.
I hope you like the book.
Yeah, you guys are going to like the book, and even still, you have to buy it. It's at the link of our episode notes. So this is happening. You're buying it. So thank you guys so much for listening to yet another episode of Romero Unseen. We'll be back again next week with a whole new topic. And thank you for joining us yet again, Adam.
Thanks so much, Josh.
Thank you so much for listening to Development Hell. If you enjoy this podcast, then please do us a major favor of leaving us 5 stars and writing a positive review. It really makes all the difference in the world. We'll see you next week with a brand new episode of Development Hell.
Thank you for listening to the Dread Podcast Network.